Hello and welcome to the Conservationists Assemble podcast with me, your host, Johnny Bloxham. Episode 1 is finally here and I'm excited to open the doors to the Conservationist Assemble community with the show that each week invites on an animal advocate or environment enthusiast to discuss all things surrounding a particular species or habitat. So sit back and relax as we talk all things otter. Please welcome to the podcast, Jason Palmer. Okay, Jason, hello, how are you?
Hello, Johnny, I'm good, thank you, very well, thank you, yeah.
Good, thank you for joining us on the podcast today. We're here to talk all thing otters, and there are amazing little creatures that I'm very excited to talk to with you about today. So, yeah, please, could you tell us a little bit about otters?
A little bit about otters. So otters are mustelids, so they're related to things like badgers and skunks and ferrets and weasels. There are 13 species around the world, and they live pretty much everywhere except Australia and Antarctica. They're aquatic, so they live mainly in bodies near in or around bodies of water, whether that be freshwater, lakes, rivers, streams, or marine environments. So they're quite adaptable. They're pretty amazing little creatures. Apex predators, so they're at the top of the food chain.
Fantastic. So yeah, quite successful and would you say quite an intelligent animal as well?
Very intelligent, very adaptable. So that they cover a wide range of geographic areas. Some are highly sociable, some are highly solitary. So very, very different in the ways they live, but they all fit in their little niches in the wild very well. They do what they do very, very well.
Right. And we are trying to repopulate otters into this country, are we?
Yeah. So back in the 1970s, the Eurasian, or what we call British otter, was virtually extinct in the UK, mainly due to our dirty rivers, pesticides, DDT in the rivers, hunting, trapping, poaching, really had a big impact on them. And British otters are solitary. So once you start knocking one out, it makes it harder for them to find each other, and you know, the numbers crash quickly. Since the mid-1970s into the 1980s, rivers have been cleaned up, otters were protected, and there's been a lot of people doing a lot of hard work to try and get the population back. So we've gone from virtually zero, and we reckon, nobody knows exactly sure how many there are in the UK now, but we reckon between 10 and 12,000.
Oh,
a rough guess, which is really, really good numbers.
That is a lot stronger number than I would have ever anticipated, having returned to the UK. So yeah, hopefully they can continue that fantastic work and another apex predator back. Because
exactly, they're in every county in England now, and they're good numbers in Scotland and Wales. So they're definitely on the comeback. It's good for the otter.
Right, great, fantastic. And aside from then the Eurasian otter, what kind of status are we looking at necessarily for other endangered species of otter if they are classified as endangered or worse?
So out of the 13 species, every single one apart from one is classed as declining in numbers, under threat, near threatened, endangered. It's only the North American otter or Canadian otter that is actually, I think, now least concern, and that's been with a lot of hard work to try and get the numbers back up. But the other 12 species across the globe are suffering. The numbers are declining rapidly, mainly due to poaching, hunting, illegal pet trade, habitat destruction, pollution, that sort of thing.
Right. And so then, are there, you know, any in-situ conservation projects that zoos and other in-situ conservation organisations are kind of in partnership with or help support across the globe to kind of help them bounce back as well as maybe the North American otter has or the Eurasian otter is doing?
Yeah, there's actually a lot of work going on with otters around the globe. I'm part of the IUCN Otter Specialist Group, and apparently it's one of the most proactive, inclusive, energetic specialist groups there is. So we have about 300 members, all volunteers, and they interconnect across the globe with in situ and ex situ work. So we've got people in North America doing stuff with sea otters. We've got Himalayan Otter Network in Nepal, Bhutan doing survey work. So they work with local communities, training locals how to survey for otters. And in many parts of the world, for a lot of otter species ranges, we still don't know where they are exactly. We're still finding them pop up in places we hadn't seen them, or we're not finding them in places that they should be there. But for pretty much every species, there is a group of people working on protection, education, awareness, in situ and ex situ.
Oh, that's fantastic. And yeah, nice to know that for the most part, all of the endangered species or the species that are at risk have got a little bit of representation, if not more so. Because I'm assuming that there are some species that are easier to get representation for and some others that aren't.
I mean, otters are quite lucky in the fact that they are all cute and cuddly and very favorable with the general public wherever you are in the world. So most people will see the otter as a something that is nice. It's not a not an ugly animal. So a lot of people have a soft spot for otters. It's generally the only people sort of conflict, human wildlife conflict, is with fishermen, obviously,
Of
in
course,
certain areas. But with the right education and the right protection and the right support for local communities, there's a lot of people out there working to negate that and make it work for the otter and the local people.
amazing. So for those conservation projects like the Himalayan Otter Network, for example, in Nepal, and are they getting any government support to try and help with otter conservation, or is it entirely kind of
Pretty much all local NGOs, I think. I do quite a bit of work trying to raise funds and awareness for projects like that. There are rescue centres around the world. There's not a lot of government funding going on. It is generally sort of people off their own backs doing the volunteering and working to raise funds and monies and support. Not government funded, I'm afraid.
Hopefully in the future, but
Hopefully in the
it's
future, yeah.
nice that yeah, certainly in areas of the world, people are willing to give their hard-earned time and money still to looking after endangered species.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a lot. I mean, I quite often get a lot of email contact from my OSG, Otter Specialist Group, friends and colleagues. And quite often, I imagine most of them to be very serious, slightly older professor types. And it's not the case. There's a lot of young people out there working to support otters. And it's always so nice to see a young, fresh face out there actually sort of really keen to getting involved and engaged in their otter, in their country, that they've got a soft spot for, which is fantastic.
That is good. And ultimately, obviously, being from an ex situ background, we can relate that the younger generation is certainly where a lot of our efforts are targeted, aren't they? Because going forward, they are, generationally going to be the ones that continue the work and improve the work of what we're laying down for them.
Exactly. It's the young generation we have to sort of bring in and involve and make sure that they're aware of what's going on, not just with otters, but with any species. If kids have a certain passion for a certain type of animal, then it's to be encouraged that they're made aware of that animal's sort of needs and requirements, not only in the wild, but in captivity as well.
So then going forward, what kind of actions and changes would you say that everybody can take to, not necessarily who just us from a conservation background can take to help improve the chances of survival of otters here in the UK, but also kind of globally as well?
Probably one of the biggest things we can do is probably respect our rivers. Littered plastic bottles, rubbish in being dropped and ending up in litters or in the sea is very, very bad, and it affects all wildlife. Another big thing is the social media impact of you see a lot of images of cute pet otters on social media, TikTok, Facebook, that it's really sad, but a lot of those otters are taken from the wild. They don't make good pets. They can be dangerous. They do smell. They have highly complex social family needs, and for them to become pets is really a very, very wrong thing. So all the time people are clicking and liking and sharing these things, it's driving and fueling the illegal pet trade. So
Of
it's,
course.
don't like, don't click. It's hard not to, but you're doing the otter a favor if you just steer well clear of that sort of thing.
And I suppose this is where we can say that if you are that way inclined to, you know, go and look for footage, including otters on the internet, because there is a lot. There is a, you know, a reputable kind of footage from resources like these wildlife conservation organizations, or, you know, zoos that have these amazing social media teams, and is actually one of the best resources that modern zoos have for people to then like and share and support, and they'll get their cute otter fix, but also promote and drive the right message.
Exactly. If you've got a local good zoo and that zoo is doing good work with otters, support them. Click, share, like what they're doing with regards to their otters, because that will help raise more awareness. You know, the otters are in a good place, they're being well looked after. If you want endless bits of otter footage, then Otters in the Wild is always good. There's really a lot of groups out there now doing camera trap footage, and we're getting some really good otter footage, which is amazing to see. Otters in the Wild, actually, Singapore's quite famous for the Singapore otters. There's several groups going on there, following the families, following individuals. It's all responsibly done. It's all ethically done. You know, the otters come first, but you can pick out the characters, the individual characters in the family, and what you're seeing is them behaving completely naturally in the wild. No harm is coming to them. So that is the best way, from a social media point of view, to kind of support and enjoy otters at home if you're living in another country or this country.
Incredible, yeah. Fantastic. So that's kind of our insight into otters then. I suppose the next section of the podcast is going to be just telling us a little bit about yourself and how you've got to where you are in your career. And also, I guess, from a paying it forward aspect, we've already talked about how, you know, we're here to inspire the younger generation to, you know, pick up that mantle. Not that we're obviously in that position where, you know, you or I are giving our positions up yet. But yeah, to create that generation of the next conservationist. So yeah, first and foremost, just give us a little bit about yourself and how you got to where you currently are in your career.
How I got to where I am. How long have you got? So ever since I was 5, apparently, my mum tells me I always wanted to be a zookeeper. I never wanted to be anything else but a zookeeper. I wasn't that good at school. I'm not terrifically academically minded, so went through school, didn't really enjoy it, and at that time there wasn't really the choice of animal management and zoology type degrees or courses to do, such as there is now. So I left school, desperately wanted to work with animals, didn't think I would ever be a zookeeper, but I got a job in a pet shop, a very big pet shop, and we had all sorts of things. Really enjoyed it, loved it, stayed there a good few years. And the other thing I really wanted to do in life was travel. So from then on, I kind of worked a couple of years, got my job back, but I interspersed that with a couple of years traveling in India and Southeast Asia, came back to the UK, earned more money. I then spent 2 years traveling through Africa, came back, got another job. And that was actually an animal deal. It was a dealer, an exporter, importer. So I learned a lot. Horrific business, glad I don't do it anymore, but I got to work with possibly more different types of bird, certainly parrots, than I would ever have done in a zoo. Kind of moving on from there, a job came up at Battersea Park Children's Zoo, just posted up outside. A friend of mine saw it and said you should go for it, which I did, got the job. Yeah, and that was back in 2004-5, so, and haven't stopped since. Took a break for a couple of years, lived in the Middle East, came back and got the job at New Forest. And yeah, that's where I am now. I never set out to do otters, though. If my one piece of advice to any forthcoming or upcoming zookeeper is possibly don't pin your hopes or don't set yourself a taxa or a type of animal or a species that you may definitely want to work with. Be as open as you can and absorb everything to begin with. And then work out what you really, really enjoy.
100% agree with that. So first and foremost, for our listeners, yes, Jason is the curator at New Forest Wildlife Park. If you are in the area, or if you know, so much travel, and certainly part of your travel plans are to look for zoos, you should visit the New Forest Wildlife Park. They have five species of otter.
Four now.
Four species of otter. So if you're an otter nut, then that is the wildlife park for you. Yes, to mirror what Jason said, depending on where you go, some zoos do have what is known as a cover keeper, where you generalize in a lot of the species or all of the species. And I certainly think that is good for younger keepers, like you say, because not everyone knows what they want to work with. And some people do just want to work with everything. And there isn't a right or wrong answer, is there? It's just whatever you...
whatever it is, it's hard work. But absorb it, enjoy it, get into it, get stuck in. You know, if you're just coming into the industry and you know you want to work in a zoo, volunteer, work experience, just offer yourself up at any zoo doing anything. One of our previous members of staff here, she started in the cafe, sort of serving as waitress and behind the till in the cafe. She's now working at a very big zoo with her carpy and giraffe. You know, but that's where she started, and she had the determination to do it. And anyone that has the determination to do it, I think, still can do it.
Amazing. There you go. Yes, we like to pay it forward here on the podcast. So you say you never went into it wanting to work with otters, but what was one fact about otters that when you first kind of heard it, you're like, wow, yeah, okay, otters are cool, and yeah, maybe I am going to start giving them a little bit more of my time and my emotion.
Possibly one, I'm not so much fact or otter-centric type thing, but hairy-nosed otters. Until 1992, 1993, they were classified as extinct in the wild. They didn't think they existed anymore. And since then, they've started turning up. They're still out there. So that's a species that man thought had completely gone. We'd killed it off, like the thylacine and the dodo. But it's still out there. It's still living. We don't exactly know where it's living, and it keeps popping up all over the place in Southeast Asia. But little hairy-nosed otter is probably the, you know, it's one of those animals that no one's probably ever heard of. Real special creature. Nobody knows anything about it or very much about it. But that kind of to me, is something to kind of cling on to and really sort of drives me to do the work I do with otters.
Amazing. Yeah. And like you say, it is a species that certainly not many people have heard of. You know, when you do think about otters, there are maybe three or four species of otter now that I'd say are really in the public eye. And probably most recently, for lack of a better word, sea otters are the trend at the moment, aren't they? But yeah, you've got your Asian short clawed, which quite often the ones that we do see in the pet trade video, sadly. And then certainly, yeah, in this country, we are aware of Eurasians. But yeah, there's a whole menagerie of other species of otters there that really kind of slip beneath the radar.
Exactly, yeah. They're all over the place. And they're all, you know, I quite often get emails or comments or questions, you know, and it's very generic. I have otters, or do otters do this? It's, well, you've got 13 different types and they're all unique. They're all individual in the way they live, their habitat, their environment, their social structure. They, you know, they're very, very different, and very complex. And it's kind of, you know, can't lump them all as one. Otters are all very, very different.
Absolutely. So do you have any light-hearted or fun stories from around your time with otters? Because they are very mischievous animals.
They are very mischievous. I suppose, thinking about it, we had one otter here called Alpha. And Alpha was a Eurasian otter. He was a British otter, and he lived till he was about 19 years old, which for an otter is very old. Average wild lifespan is about 8 years old. Alpha lived with us here at the New Forest Wildlife Park, and he managed to escape out of every single enclosure we had. He got out. We always got him back, and he kind of, I don't know, made a game of it. And in his last few years, he was getting a bit cronky and a bit old and a bit tired. He'd still charge at you, he'd still rush you, and he'd still show you who was boss. But his last few years, he kind of escape out the enclosure, and then he'd sit and wait by the door, by the gate, for you to let him back in. And it's kind of, you could see it in his face, like, I've still got it. You know, I can still do this. You know, you're going to have to keep up with me here.
Yeah,
yeah, he was such an individual character.
Bless him. Yeah, he just sounds like he was best in you, not because he wanted to, just because
Just
he
because,
could.
yeah, just because he could. Yeah,
Yeah,
yeah.
brilliant. Well, that sounds very fun indeed, and certainly sounded like he kept you on his toes. And so, what as a curator now, probably moving away more from otters, but what does a typical day look like for you?
Typical day that I don't think that I ever have a typical day. It's
No, that's
very varied. Obviously, I do New Forest Wildlife Park, curator for here. I'm also curator for Battersea Park Children's Zoo. So two very different zoos, two very different environments, and two very different collections of species. So it's with the exotics, Bali starlings, meerkats, primates up at Battersea. We've got the European stuff down here. I like to try and be out with my keepers as much as possible. I think it's very important that any manager, curator spends time with his staff. You should never expect any of your staff to do anything that you wouldn't do. So, if they're mucking out a pond or sweeping up leaves or collecting browse, then if I've got time or I'll make time, I'll go out and help them. Catching up animals, cleaning out, whatever it is that, I'd like to be out there with them. A lot of my job now is sort of the licensing paperwork, zoo licensing legislation, that sort of side of things, which I really enjoy. It's frustrating and taxing sometimes, but it's nice to have the balance of being outside doing the zookeepery job as well as doing the officey work as well. So yeah, quite a mixed day usually.
Yeah, and it's obviously, yeah, it's important to, push the importance of the office-based stuff because, you go back obviously to the mindset of a lot of people that still have their idea of zoos being these places of entertainment and yeah, like I say, is the office stuff, but it has its importance as well, doesn't it? Because it's just showing how modern zoos and wildlife parks and ex situ conservation organisations are progressing.
Exactly. I don't think the public realise how much legislation, paperwork, compliance, health and safety, welfare, ethics on the paperwork side of things has to go through for us to be compliant. And, both our zoos and my bosses think that we should try and always keep the highest standards possible, and we should always be trying to push for higher standards even more. So if there's something we can do it better. Then we will do our best to do that, and it's constantly keeping on top of things and making sure that every level, every person, every member of staff, every animal is being looked after to the best that we can.
Yeah, and that's the good thing, isn't it? Is that while we have those guidelines that are laid out for us, they are just guidelines, and in pretty much every good zoo's case, they don't just want to meet those standards; they want to push them,
They want
and
to
that
push
is
them, yeah.
exactly, and that is what makes it so worthwhile being part of this industry.
Definitely. And it's nice to work in an industry where generally we've got Marwell Zoo up the road, we've got Poulton's Park. We're never seen as in competition with each other. We're all doing the same job for the same reason. So, if those guys up there want help from us or I need advice, then it's whatever zoo generally. I can give them a call or send them an email, and you always get a nice, friendly reply with help back. So it's that nice big sort of team effort that really works as well. It's quite inspiring.
You're never alone.
No.
So obviously being a wee lad and knowing from 5 years old that you wanted to work with animals, were there any particular influences in your journey to get to where you are today?
I mean, I've got to say, David Attenborough. I mean, Life on Earth came out his probably first big TV sort of colour series when I was 6, 7, 8 years of age, so sort of mid 70s. Animal Magic, Johnny Morris. I mean, it's a bit old hat now, and but for me as a kid growing up, watching the zookeeper in the zoo with the animals and giving them voices and personalities was kind of it worked for me. So yeah. And always having pets at home, my parents always let me sort of have different types of pets and stuff, and always enjoyed looking after animals. So yeah.
Yeah, I mean, going back to the Johnny Morris thing, I've never seen it, but you can almost see how there might be a time where we come full circle and almost go back to that because of again, going back to those modern social media techniques that engage the visitors and even when they're not actually on site at an ex situ organisation, having that kind of entertaining thing can help drive the footfall through the park and get the funding and the awareness and raise everything that we need to raise.
Exactly. It's a fine line to follow. And obviously, making animals talk and putting voices in them, it's a kind of a grey area. But I think for most of sort of Joe public, the general public, if you take an individual animal and you give it a personality and you give it, you know, it makes it something. It makes you want to care for it more because this animal has thoughts. It lives, it exists, and it's not just something to be used and disposed of and used for entertainment. I think if it's done rightly and sensitively in the right manner, then it probably is just a positive thing and not such a bad thing.
Definitely.
Didn't do me any harm watching Johnny Morris, you know, sit with gorillas and give them. Get them funny voices and stuff.
No, and it was it's like I say, as filming techniques improve, what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable will quickly be defined, but then other than that, you're quite limitless in that sense.
Exactly, and I think we also have to be careful not to go in the other direction and make everything AI and sort of CGI generated and stuff, because then you've taken away the individuality and the realness of that animal. You know, a lot of people are anti-zoo, but I remember going to a zoo as a kid and smelling an elephant. You know, that's never going to happen on a screen. And then that smell sticks with you for the rest of your life. It's a very, very individual smell, and you recognize it. And I think once that absorbs into your brain, it's like, that's what that animal smells like. You know, it makes it real.
Perfect. Yeah, it does. Absolutely. And that is, I mean, as a zookeeper, when you are mucking out a hoofstock house and you just hear a school group coming in and all they've got to say is that it smells, you know that something's going in, though. It's like you say, it's a sensory experience.
Exactly.
Even if
yeah,
the animals aren't around because we're not cleaning in with them, for example, they are still gaining something from that experience there and then.
Yeah, exactly. They're absorbing it, even if it is absorbing the smell. Yeah, and with otters, that is it's a very
definitely
defined smell. Yeah.
It is. So then, kind of on the counter side, you've had your influences. Have there been any particular hurdles in your career?
I suppose the fact that I wasn't very academically minded. You know, I suppose I'm quite lucky. I slipped through before the last sort of 10, 15 years where degrees and qualifications and certifications seems to be much more prevalent. A lot of colleges are doing animal management courses. I kind of got through just sheer hard work, determination and not giving up. You know, I was willing to do anything. So as my career progressed and I changed jobs, I generally always started back on the bottom, sweeping, cleaning, which was fine. I still really enjoy that. It's not a problem, but then having to work back up. But I suppose that's the thing. Not being the sharpest pencil in the box when it comes to sort of learning stuff. But I think with animals, you can, most of it is just learning on the job anyway. You know, nobody can teach you exactly how to look after every single species that could be under your care. With the otters, I did get a lot of knockbacks when I started deciding to sort of bring in and compile the UK and the European Asian short-clawed otter stud book. A lot of people said it wasn't possible. There was too much missing information. Don't bother with it. You're mad. You'll never do it. There's too many otters. And looking back now, I've done it. You know, I now run the global stud book, and the monitoring for EASA is now hopefully going to be an EEP. So to go from nothing and take it up that far, and the determination not to give up, you know, I could have just said, no, okay, fine, I won't bother with it. It's too much. No one's interested. But, you know, my gut feeling was it needed doing.
Yeah.
There was a lot of people elsewhere, particularly in the IUCN, And even in the ASA that said, no, 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 if you can do it, do it. You know, it won't be easy. You might not make it, but at least give it a try, which I did. So, yeah, don't ever give up.
There we go. Yeah, exactly that. And there's always, you know, there's always going to be room for everyone in an animal sector. Obviously, it is a very competitive industry, and I think it's quite easy to get disheartened. But yeah, if we're all cut from the same cloth, and there's always going to be a great support system around, isn't there, for anyone looking to get involved in this industry?
Exactly. Yeah, and I think as long as you're passionate and willing, and you understand the term hard work, and you're out there, so in all weathers, and you don't mind what you do, then there's nothing to stop you progressing and doing well. You know, you will get noticed. It gets harder and harder and harder these days to find staff that want to be out in the wet, mud, rain all the time. But I've got a couple of work experience guys now, guys and girls, and they're fantastic. They'll do anything in any weather conditions, and you just know that they're going to go far. They'll get where they want to go because they've got the mental attitude and the determination to do it.
Fantastic. Yeah, so I think that is a great, you know, note to finish on in terms of paying it forward and you know, it giving an insight as to maybe one route to get into this industry, because again, there isn't a right or wrong answer, and what is happened for you A could be relatable to someone else, but also could be completely different to someone else's.
And yeah, I mean, these days there's so many avenues that you can go down. You can do research, education, you know, being a zookeeper, whatever. There's so many, you know, ex situ conservation, in situ conservation. There's so many routes that you can go in. And yes, you can do it if you're highly qualified, but there are other routes and other things you can do if you're not, you know, not academically inclined, or you've got vast amounts of qualifications behind you. So yeah, choose your route, be open-minded, and just do the best you can, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's probably going throughout, you know, the podcast. This is probably something that's going to be, you know, said over and over again by different guests, is that, you know, you can make it and you will make it. And that is why I'm going to ask this question to every guest that I do have on, just, you know, to provide that platform for people to feel like they're not alone trying to get into this industry.
Yeah, it can be lonely and it can be tough, and particularly nowadays with so many students wanting to get into the industry, it's very cutthroat, and you have to stand out and above everybody else. But if you really want it, then you'll get it. You know, you will make it.
Right. But are there any particular myths, or, you know, being out as a zookeeper while visitors are wandering around, you do hear all sorts of things. So are there any myths or stereotypes or bits of misinformation that you quite often hear that are associated with otters that you kind of want to put to rest?
Yeah, I think there's two main ones that come to mind. It's with our British Eurasian otter, that they hang around in packs, and hordes of them go around raiding rivers and eat everything. That they're highly solitary. They'll only eat as much as they need. And they generally, I mean, the average female British otter will have 12 to 14 kilometres of river territory. And that's one animal in that, you know, that amount of space isn't going to eat all the fish. So I think that's kind of a myth. Certain factions think they will hang around in vast numbers, hordes of them going around up and down rivers, which they don't. I think the other one is, which I hear all the time, is our Asian short-clawed otters. Oh, look at the babies, aren't they cute? They're not. They're all fully grown. They're all adult, and that's as big as they get. Yeah, the misconception that just because it's small, it's a baby. And then they go on to our giant otters and think that they're the parents. It's, it's not quite working like that. So
wonderful. Jason, there are 1 to 5 dream species that you'd either love to work with or to have seen in the wild. Obviously, you've mentioned you've travelled a bit, so you may have even seen some of them already.
Yeah, I've seen a fair few. I suppose seeing alive Quetzal, which is a South American bird, quite a fancy iridescent green and purple and white bird. Hairy-nosed otter, obviously. I would love to see one of those. I would love to look after one of those in captivity, actually, if it ever came up. What else? Dodo. I'm at heart, I'm a kind of a big bird nerd. So particularly parrots, so yeah, and other birds, but dodo, if they were still around these days, I would love to either see one or certainly have a go at looking after one. Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. So yeah, some quite good answers there, definitely. And it's one that's just fun to let your imagination go wild if money wasn't an object or anything like that and you had the time. So yeah, cool to see that obviously outside of otters, there are lots of other animals that you have an appreciation for.
Definitely.
And if then, you did find yourself moving on, is there one country or continent that you'd absolutely love to call home?
Africa,
Yeah.
hands down, without any hesitation, it would be Africa. If I could go back there at any point and work or live, then I would be happy to do so. Yeah, I've traveled quite extensively across Africa, but I would, yeah, there's so much to it, and every country is completely different. So yeah, my heart will always be in Africa, I think.
Amazing. And there you go. I mean, it probably doesn't take much convincing, and certainly I think a lot of aspiring animal advocates would choose Africa as their answer. And yeah, they're probably not needing much of a kick up the butt to get on a plane and go out there anytime
No,
soon. But
just need the offer to come through, and I'm off.
exactly. So when you're not working, how do you keep busy? What do you do for fun or to relax? Because it's also very taxing and labor intensive
Yeah, I
role.
mean, I still a lot of my otter work I do actually in my spare time, but I find that quite therapeutic. Certainly going back on kind of historical data and stud books and looking into the history of otters being kept in zoos, I really enjoy that. So that's kind of my nerdy time at home. I love my garden, really love gardening. And I suppose if I've got time off, history, so love visiting a castle. Love Romans, Greeks, ancient Egyptians. So anything, any museums or castles or Roman villas out there on a day off, I'm more than happy to go and wander around and learn about that sort of stuff. Completely different to zoos, but I think you quite often need that break, that separation. And if I hadn't
Absolutely.
become a zookeeper, I would have been an archaeologist.
There you go. There you have it.
So.
Perfect. Okay. So have you got any last messages for our listeners or shout it out to your colleagues, your friends, your peers, or anything like that?
Basically, thanks to all the zoos that have ever replied to any of my emails. I know I can be an absolute pain in the backside sometimes with requesting information, but it is flipping around now because a lot of the zoos are, the word's getting out there, so they're emailing me for advice and help, which is awesome. So I'm always there to assist on anything otter. But yeah, if you work in a zoo and you've got otters or any species that you're particularly fond of, get involved. Contact the stud bookkeeper. Do some work to get some funds raised, some awareness raised for in situ conservation, and kind of push it for yourself, but push it for the species that you really enjoy as well. I think that would be my word of wisdom to end on that.
Thank you to Jason for his time today. Be sure to follow the work of New Forest Wildlife Park and Battersea Park Zoo, and if you are ever around the respective areas, do plan a visit as your support goes a long way for conservation. I hope you have enjoyed the first episode of the Conservationist Assemble podcast. Please follow the podcast on Instagram at Conservationist Assemble Pod. I'd also appreciate if you could subscribe and give a 5-star rating wherever you get your podcasts and share the podcast with family, friends and colleagues, as this will help get the word out and support the Conservationist Assembled community, as there is a lot more great conservation-based content yet to come. Most importantly, thank you for listening and be sure to listen out for our next episode coming soon.